Lobinger in?
Jonathan Lobinger.
You see, even my name sounds better when Jordan says it.
It does, yeah. Nothing against you. Yeah, Jordan's just, you're just articulate, man. Say my name.
Jonathan Lobinger.
That sounds so much better. What's going on, guys? Thanks for joining. We're on Criterion Now 38. So I guess we'll just introduce the two guests. We have, let me guess, Jonathan Lobinger. Say it, Jordan.
Bonjour. Bonsoir.
So, Jonathan, it's been a little bit. And in fact, I must apologize to you. I got sick, like, right before we were going to podcast the last time. And then, as it turns out, that was the flu. It, like, just hit right about recording time, and I felt bad. So, I'm healthy now.
Good. I'm glad.
Hello?
I'm glad. I'm glad you were healthy. And it's always a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you for asking me to come back on. And thank you for finally apologizing to me.
I think I've apologized about 10 times on the show, actually. I felt bad. And Jordan, first time, long time. So you've been on David's podcast. And and I'm sorry, Jordan, before I get to you, Jonathan has Film Baby Film podcast. That's important to mention. That's going pretty well. I haven't seen the episodes in a couple weeks, but you still doing some of those?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And in fact, I have a Thor episode in the can. And tomorrow I am very excited because I'm recording an episode on Fritz Lang's M with a criminal defense attorney who specializes in murder defense cases. So I'm
awesome.
Yeah, I'm pretty thrilled about it.
I can't wait to hear that. And so, Jordan, you're kind of, I guess, a little newer to the family, but you've been on David's Criterion Reflections, I think, every episode. I haven't had a chance to listen to the latest, but is that right?
Yeah, no, I've been on every one so far, and that's been a lot of fun. Like, we've been watching a lot of films that I hadn't seen before. So it's been really cool. But you're going to have to apologize to me now because you interrupted my introduction the first time around. So I'm hoping that...
I'm deeply apologetic. Yeah, boy, I probably shouldn't get into the apology rabbit hole this week. But Jordan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks for asking me to be on. This is going to be cool. We got a hell of a rundown here.
Yeah, so this is a little different vibe from David's. We don't get as in-depth, but anyway, do you want to just tell people, if they haven't heard David's, what you're about?
Sure.
What is Jordan Esso? What's the essence of Esso?
The essence of Esso. I thought we were going to do short takes. Like, this is going to take a while. The essence is so complicated. So I'm an actor, writer, director, artist, and a big fan of Second Breakfast. I think those are the things you should know about me.
All right, Lord of the Rings reference there, right?
Oh, absolutely. No? I'm not a huge Lord of the Rings fan, but that is a good line. And
yeah,
true.
Well,
I mean,
you borrowed it. Yeah, me too.
First breakfast is like the yogurt and the coffee, and then like an hour later, it's the eggs and the fried turkey, and that's when things get real.
I'm in.
Did you just say fried turkey?
Well, like, not the whole turkey. More like
but you have fried turkey for breakfast? Jordan, you continue to grow in my estimation.
And Thanksgiving's right around the corner. So, yeah, you can fry a whole turkey and eat it for breakfast.
Yeah, wait till I fry the whole turkey. Then it's going to be epic. That'll be third breakfast, I think.
Yeah, and dinner, too. And maybe, like, sandwiches for the whole week. So, Criterion Now. We have a lot of stuff to talk about. Actually, it's a little overwhelming this week, but I think I have a good couple people to talk about with it. In fact, actually, let's just get right into it. Jonathan, so this week I bought an Oppo player, or is it Odo? I keep saying
Oppo.
Oppo.
I have no idea if that's the correct pronunciation, but
Oppo, Oppo, Odo. It's not Odo. That was just an inside joke because the packaging looks like the P's look like D's. So what was funny is after the Arrow episode, you blamed me for you buying a hugely expensive Blu-ray player that I don't own.
The Oppo 203 was something that had been recommended to me. It's an Ultra HD and Blu-ray player that had been recommended to me by a friend who's into hi-fi equipment. And I was sort of on the fence about getting it. But then I wanted to, after the Arrow 1 episode, I went out and wanted to buy all these Region B Blu-rays. Mm-hmm. And then I got the Oppo region free. And then I mentioned, what should I get? What's the best region free player? And you jumped in and said, well, if you want the best, the Oppo 2 or 3 from Bombay.
Right. So I think that was based on recommendations from friends of mine and people that we in our circles. But I didn't have one. And it's been on my wish list on Amazon. I see it and I'm like, damn, it's a lot of money. But you inspired me, and I guess I can blame you. I bought one. It'll be here Monday. And but yours has been there. You've had it for a week or two now?
Aaron, welcome to the Oppo family.
So is it worth it? I mean, do you notice a difference between just upscaling and...
So, and I mentioned this as soon as I got it. So I'm not a picture quality expert. Like, I'm definitely not the authority on this sort of thing. But actually, I think that makes my take on it almost even better, because I was even able to notice a difference just watching the Blu-rays immediately. I think the first one I watched was something from the Boon Well set. So that would have been The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie. And
good one.
And just, I'm almost like tempted to swear, but holy crap. Immediately,
you can swear. It's fine.
Holy shit!
This show, it's okay.
No, so immediately, as soon as I saw it, I thought, this just looks absolutely beautiful. So I was very happy with my purchase. I was nervous about it because it was not inexpensive, and I didn't know if I would notice a difference or get any benefit out of it. And immediately, the region free worked great, and the picture quality, I could see the improvement right away. So I was very happy.
Well, how would you describe the improvement? What is it like? Higher like tonal value, or are you seeing different colors you didn't see in the other player, or what are you seeing?
The other players don't have blue.
That's what's amazing about it.
You get blue.
Yeah, I like I said, I'm definitely not the authority. This is not something I'm an expert on, but when I watched it, the real thing that I felt was it felt more like I was watching something, even though it was the same size TV, it felt more like I was watching something on film or something at a movie theater rather than just watching a Blu-ray on my TV. So it felt more that way.
Cool. I don't have many. I did buy that Close Encounters 4K Blu-ray that came out. It was just too cheap. I think it was like $15 a couple weeks ago or a few weeks ago. And I had Oblivion. I bought that when I bought my last Blu-ray player, thinking I had the disc player. And then I put that in, and that was a disappointment. So that's just been waiting for me. So, Jordan, do you have any 4K players?
No, I've never really seen 4K other than demoed at the store. I have the Revenant on 4K, but it looks the same in the packaging as the regular Blu-ray. I don't know if that's that might be an expert opinion. I'm not sure.
That's great. Well, anyway, so more on that. I'll of course share my mileage with the Oppo or Oppo or Odo, and but no Criterion's in 4K yet. But I think just from what I understand about the player is that even regular Blu-rays look better and sound better, and I think just the player functions better. I understand even like opening the tray is what I hear is even nicer. I don't know if you can speak to that, Jonathan.
I mean, I think I don't know when it was or who makes these sort of decisions, but I think at the price point, it's pretty much known as like the best. And this was not just me saying it because I bought it, but I'd been told before, and I've read articles that suggest that the 203 at the time that it came out was like the best in its class. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, no, that's what I've heard, but. People like what they buy. Talk to somebody about their phone someday. people defend their phones. So anyway, done with Blu-ray players and phones, and let's talk about some Criterions. We had the Philadelphia Story came out this week, and the next week is Le Samurai and Desert Hearts, and then the week after that is Jabberwocky. I'm actually holding off on all of these because we're also in the middle of the Barnes & Noble sale, so I'm just going to kind of grab them at one time when I'm out of town. You guys have any thoughts? And wow, this is tough with Jonathan and Jordan because I usually go alphabetically. So I guess Jonathan, I guess N comes before R. So start with you. Any thoughts on this grouping?
Sure. So I had tickets to see Desert Hearts, but I was so busy at work I didn't actually get to go see it. It was showing here at the Brattle. I missed it, but I'm certainly looking forward to checking that out. But I think of this group, the only one that I've seen so far is Le Samurai. I haven't seen the other ones. But I think the one I'm most looking forward to picking up is The Philadelphia Story. I've heard lots of good things about it and looking forward to checking it out.
Me too. I haven't heard much since it came out. I think everybody's waiting for Barnes & Noble. So, Jordan, any thoughts on this batch?
I think the one I'm looking the most forward to, well, Le Samurai I've seen too, and it's beautiful, like the epitome of cool. So that's for granted that I'll get that. But I'm curious about Desert Hearts, and I think it's coming on Filmstruck right around the time that the physical edition is released, so I'll probably watch it there first. I mean, it's kind of cool to see, you know, a film where it's mostly about women over 30. That's not the usual, so that's what interests me most about it. But I'm not sure how melodramatic it is. I watched the trailer, and so I'm curious about that. Jabberwocky, probably not as much. And, you know, I know Philadelphia Story is a really treasured film. I find it a little boring. So I'm curious about the transfer. Like, I love black and white film in high definition, so I'm curious to watch it, but it's not my favorite film.
Okay. Well, expectations tempered. Boring is not fun, but okay. Well, that's coming out this week, so we'll have a lot of them to talk about in the coming weeks. So speaking of things coming out in the coming weeks, or actually months, we're also going to get February 2008 predictions. So that'll be pretty easy. February 2018 predictions, and that should come out, or should be announced Wednesday on the 15th. Of course, it could be 16th, could be Thursday, Friday, but we'll get them this week. And I love the threads that we have going in the group about the group predictions. So if you don't mind, if you'll humor me, I actually didn't pull it up, so I'm going to find it. Oh, actually, no, I did. No, I didn't. All right, humor me. Talk about something, guys.
So there's got to be, was Silence of the Lambs the top vote getter? All the ones that we either know are coming soon or we've been expecting forever were the top vote getters. But I don't remember exactly what the order was.
By a mile, Silence of the Lambs. And actually, Mark Herney made a really good argument about why that is at the top. He said that because it's Valentine's Day and nothing goes down like a... I'm going to read his comment when I find the thread. He said, "Nothing says love for Valentine's Day like having your significant other with some fava beans and a nice Chianti. So, yeah, cute, Mark. So.
Well, I put an Attenberg in the poll, and I think it has two votes, including mine. Are you sure that's not number one?
I'm pretty sure, but in fact, we're going to get to Attenberg. I haven't seen that's the Athena Sangari film, which is actually on Filmstruck. That's why we'll get to it. But so Silence of the Lambs was way, like, it had double the votes of the second place, which is Grand Budapest Hotel. I don't think that's coming yet. I don't know. I think they'll drop some hints for that. I think they'll build some anticipation. Night of the Living Dead, which it seems about right with the release, but of course that screams Halloween to me. I don't know if they'll wait that long. Elevator to the Gallows, Passion of Joan of Arc, which we'll talk about in a second. Tree of Life, which I think Jordan likes. Dead Man. Somebody put literally Wong Kar Wai in a box.
I'm still holding out for the Wong Kar Wai box set, guys.
But this is just Wong Kar Wai in a box.
That's
only
which is not nice considering he's still alive. So this is.
I know. That's pretty dark.
I guess
guys.
It's sticking with the Silence of the Lambs theme.
So my joke was limited edition of one, and there's only one spine. So also very dark. But no, Wong Kar Wai will not be showing up at your house unless I don't know unless you call him, I guess. So anyway, there are a lot of. Lot of items on the list. I figured we'd just this month go around and just talk about, you know, what that's been rumored we're looking forward to, or the one we want. So Jonathan, you want to go ahead?
Yeah. So like I said, I'm obviously excited for the possibility that more Wong Kar Wai films will come out on physical media or will get re-released. But the one that I picked was actually the Grand Budapest Hotel. I am of the generation where Wes Anderson films have always been event films, where as soon as they come out in the movie theater, you go see them. But I think with the exception of Royal Tenenbaums, I haven't actually gone back to revisit any of them. And I think that I really liked Grand Budapest Hotel, and I want to rewatch it. So this is I want to revisit the movie. So release the Blu-ray to give me a good excuse to do so.
I've actually seen it three times, and I'm not the biggest Wes Anderson fan, but yeah, that's just right up my alley. I think it'll probably be summer. I could be wrong, though. We'll find out. So if I am wrong, I'm going to apologize to you again, Jonathan.
Well, what is it? It isn't Wes Anderson coming out? And I think Matt Gasteyer pointed this out. Isn't Isle of Dogs coming out in February? Is that the name of his new movie, the animated film?
It is, and I think that... See, my argument is I think he likes to be very hands-on with his releases, and so I think that with Isle of Dogs and the post-production and the promotion, I think he just won't have time. But he could be onto something. He might want to promote this with the new film. But yeah, I think it is around February, maybe March of next year.
Yeah, so Ralph Fiennes in Grand Budapest Hotel is just amazing. Very good comic performance. Yeah.
So quotable. Yeah, he's a blast. I love Ralph Fiennes. Oh boy, please nothing negative come out about Ralph Fiennes this week. And yes, we're not getting into all these sexual scandals, but you kind of can't help but they're on our minds. So Jordan, any titles you want this week? Or
I mean, I don't keep very good track of the rumors and, you know, what distributors Criterion has really good relationships with. So I know Tree of Life is likely. I know that has been rumored. It's one of my very favorite films, so that would be amazing. I mean, especially if we got an alternate cut or like the standalone film about the universe that Malick did. There's a number of ways in which that release could be like pretty phenomenal. So I would look forward to that for sure.
How about an 8-hour creation story film?
I'm in.
I am in too. That's my favorite sequence. My wife will be out of the house if I put that back on. You also mentioned Attenberg and Dogtooth. I don't think those are... Well, Attenberg maybe. Yeah, we'll get to that when film struck.
Well, I could say one thing that won't spoil our conversation for later, that, Tsongari's films have been promoted a lot by Filmstruck, and they did that Meet the Filmmaker series, and then they've done this last push for her work before it expires from the service. And I just feel like they all have Criterion branding. It's a bunch of shorts. That is her masterpiece, and it could really be packaged with most of those shorts and supplemental materials. Like, everybody always wants Tarantino to be in the Criterion collection. He was the, you know, head of the jury at Venice Film Festival when that film was up for the Golden Lion. Like, there's possibilities to really create a pretty stellar package for this movie. And Criterion clearly believes in her as a filmmaker. So I voted for Dogtooth just because someone else put it on there. It's a cool film. We'll get to it. I don't think that's coming. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think Attenberg's actually not a bad guess.
Okay. All right, cool. My pick was not really on the list, but people, well, it was. People were talking about 4 months, 3 weeks.
2 days, right?
4 months, 2 days, right. So I have to get my month, week, day sequence down, my calendar down. And then, of course, Beyond the Hills was rumored. This is Christian. I struggle with this last name, but I think it's Mungiu or Myungiu. Something like that. So basically what I would like is just anything Romanian New Wave. And I think they have a couple, but and actually, no, I don't think they even have a couple. So this one is not based on rumor, but my choice would be The Death of Mr. Lazarescu, which is a masterpiece. But and it had some buzz when it came out. It's been a good 10-plus years now. Not an easy film. A few of these Romanian films are, especially 4 months is very difficult. But it really needs to be recognized. Actually, I think it's on the Sight and Sound list. So there's that. But hopefully they can get it. It seems like it would be up Criterion's alley. So, all right. Well, I guess we'll find out Wednesday. And, aside from it, so Dead Man has been rumored because of The Clue. Somebody had potato in a box. I don't think that's happening. Tom Jones, we've kind of forgotten about that. Let's see what else. Somebody said Super Bowl box set. I'm not seeing that, but you never know. Berlanga Eclipse, and yeah, we'll see. So, all right, well, there's big Bergman news this week.
Huge so Bergman news.
Yes, huge. So Keith, I don't know if Keith is getting in trouble here because I think he made it sound like they told him something, but then he said no. He kind of pieced that together that there was going to be a centennial event this year, and so everybody said Bergman because his birthday is in I think July. On the last episode, he kind of backed off that a little bit and said they hadn't told him anything. And now there's 30 films coming to the Film Forum for the Bergman Centennial in February, and then they're and this is through Janus, and then they're going to tour across the country. I'm sure they're going to hit you, Jonathan, probably hit the Brattle, and Jordan, you're in LA, right?
Yeah.
So they'll definitely come there, I think, as well. So it's, yeah, 30 films, I think pretty much everything on Criterion, a couple that aren't yet. There are a few omissions. His last film is in the grouping, Sarah Band, which I think is pretty good. But I wish it was in this grouping because I think it fits. It's Bergman's last film. But anyway, dare I ask if you guys are excited for a centennial tour of Ingmar Bergman. But Jordan, what you think?
Oh, I love Bergman so much. I'm thrilled. Yeah, can't wait.
Yeah, Jonathan?
I went to Bergman Week last year in the middle of the Baltic Sea, and I plan on going again this year. I suspect that I will also be interested in such a box set and such a movie tour.
Yeah, I figured you're both, this is in your wheelhouse. And I noticed Faro document was Faro?
Well,
we can't say it.
Yeah, let's just say Faro or Faro. I say Furda, but I don't even think that's a correct pronunciation.
Yeah, it's okay. We're not Swedish, but yeah, that's coming. So yeah, and hopefully this will a big box set will follow. Jordan, are you I know you're into Criterion and art film. Have you gotten into buying these discs yet, or are you just more like a casual watcher?
No, I have quite a few. In fact, I think I have every Bergman release so far. So my only reservation when I hear about a box set is the double dipping factor of whatever they've released so far, I have a copy of. But I mean, I've been waiting for Winter Light to come out in a beautiful high def transfer mm-hmm. for so long that alone is probably enough to get me in the game.
Jordan, don't be coy. Don't be coy. You know you're getting this. Like, don't even pretend like the double dipping is a real concern. This thing is past the rumor stage. It's officially happening. If it doesn't happen, the internet will explode. And
John,
all
John,
three of us are getting this box set.
My wife might be listening to this. I have to sound like I have reservations.
I doubt if any wives are listening to this show, except for mine, who's about 30 feet away. But she knows I'm getting this. Yeah, I guess. If there are 10 films you already have, I don't know how many Bergman Blu-rays there are. Probably about 10, seems right. So you're going to end up rebuying 10 out of 30. And then the others you might have on Eclipse. I think the Winter Light, Silence, Through a Glass Darkly, those aren't on Blu yet. And then there's Shame, Hour of the Wolf. I noticed they're all part of the package. And then a whole bunch of others. I think Brink of Life. It's going to be a big deal.
Is The Rite on the list? Do you know? The Ritual?
I think The Rite was on the list.
Okay.
I'll actually look it up.
Cause David and
Bergman, John.
Yeah, David and I covered that recently on the show, and that was a film that I discovered in the process of doing the show with David. I'd never seen it before. It's amazing. Like, it's not a B track for Bergman. This is like a film that maybe didn't get, you know, A+ production values, but the writing is incredible and the acting is incredible. It's everything you want in a Bergman film, lacking a little bit of maybe some high-end production with sets and camera movements. And we're about to do Passion of Anna. Have you guys seen that one?
Oh, I love Passion of Anna.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Right is not on there. Sorry.
So that's a shame.
That's the wrong.
wow, that was...
I would just...
that's nominated for the brain fart of the week.
No, I think that was good. I'm
it was the wrong word, though. It's an antonym to the heteronym of right. Right as in ritual, not right as in...
It was wrong as in the Travis is wrong.
All right. You made up for it. Remember, that's good.
There's 30 titles. I'm not going to read them all, but the ones that I already mentioned jump out at me. Sawdust and Tinsel is a big deal. I think that's a great film that's not on Blu-ray here. And then The Magic Flute, I think, if you're into opera. So, yeah, it's a big deal. guess come to Criterion. I'm thinking probably it'll be a late year release. You know, of course, we're making a little bit of a leap that it'll be released at all. They might just do like a couple box sets, but yeah, I like to think it's going to be all 30. Are you guys in agreement?
Well, isn't there that beautiful Kurosawa box, like an orange red box set that had, what was it, 25 or?
It was AK-100.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't 100 films. It was 100 years. I think it was 25 films.
So I'm,
but those were DVD.
When I think of this, that's what I picture in my brain, and I'm going to be devastated. No, I won't be devastated. But like that's sort of what I'm manifesting on my vision board for those of you that are fans of The Secret. Which I'm not. Wow, I can't believe I just came up with that. No, but I'm definitely in my brain. I've been picturing this entire time a really beautiful box set sitting, you know, next to my Olympics box set, Zatoichi, all that good stuff. So
yeah,
let's hope
that's coming. Yeah, I don't recommend searching for AK-100 because you're going to get a lot of gun ads. I just, but no, it is DVD 25 films. But yeah, when you think Criterion and Janus and their history. Yeah, Kurosawa is probably top tier. Bergman, yeah, I think Bergman is top tier as well. I think also Fellini, Renoir, a handful of directors I think are deserving. Actually, I don't know when was Renoir's 100th birthday. They might have missed out on that. It might have been too late. But anyway, I'm very excited, and I think we all should be. And so are you guys going to try to, notwithstanding, Jonathan, Jordan, are you going to try to see any of these in the theater?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, especially the Films of the Faith trilogy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. My theater is talking about doing Persona this year. So and they were talking about doing this before this announcement came up. So, but yeah, I'm there. Anyway, I guess we could talk about Bergman for hours. So let's talk about a new podcast. So my good friend, like we're hanging every Thursday at Cheers. My friend slash acquaintance who's been on the show, Alicia Malone. Has launched a official Filmstruck podcast. Did you guys get a chance to check it out?
Yeah, I did.
So was it good, Jordan?
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I was worried it might feel a little produced because it's the official podcast, but it was really candid. It felt like just like an off the cuff show. It was cool.
I'd say it was a little produced. I noticed there was a commercial break. I mean, it's more produced than us,
yeah.
But maybe that's says more about us than them. I didn't listen to the interview with Aronofsky because I haven't seen Mother yet, and I just don't want to really have that informed by anything. But I'm very very happy for her. And she talked to Millie, who works on Filmstruck, and it was a very short discussion. I think these will be short episodes, 30 minutes apiece, and I'll put the iTunes link in the show notes, but. But yeah, well done, Alicia. People joked about me giving her the idea and her stealing my format, but I think she's very much entitled. She's the hostess or host of Filmstruck. So
I don't know how much you know about Mother. I avoided knowing too much about it either, and I don't think it spoils much. A little bit about the way he thinks about it, but not too much in terms of content.
Okay, well, I might try then. Yeah, I know nothing. So, and I just know that it either pisses people off or they fall in love with it. So I don't know which camp I'm going to be in.
And sometimes both at the same time. I'm in that. If there's a Venn diagram, I'm in the middle.
Yeah,
on that film.
There might be another movie we're going to talk about that might fall into that that category as well. don't even tell me if Mother compares to that. I just don't want to know. So, all right. Phantom Pages. So, I don't know, Jordan, since you don't get into the rumors and stuff, if you're really as in tune with these, but oftentimes they mean nothing. They're just pages that show up on Criterion. Lately, they've been Filmstruck often. And I think probably most of these, if they happen, are Filmstruck. But we got three new ones. One was Bill Morrison. He's done Dawson City and Decasia. He's not somebody I'm familiar with. So anybody?
Bueller? Yeah. So I just saw him at the Museum of Fine Arts. He was there with Guy Madden, and they did. They showed Dawson City, Frozen Time or Frozen in Time, and it was gorgeous.
Oh, cool.
And then he and Guy Madden did a question and answer session afterwards. So this is he absolutely would be a good fit for a physical release. Also wouldn't be too surprised if these are just like a really great doubleheader in Filmstruck or on the Criterion Channel.
So is Dawson City good? I've heard Dickasia is very good.
So I haven't seen Dickasia. I also heard it was really good. Dawson City is really good. Beautiful score. That's the thing that jumped out at me. And then also for people that listen to this podcast, people that are into film and the history of film, this is absolutely a cinephile targeted movie. It's pretty great. And I think anybody listening to this podcast, anybody that's interested in Criterion, would absolutely be interested in seeing Dawson City.
Sort of indie art film.
I've seen Dickasia. Sorry, go ahead, Jordan. I've seen Dickasia. It was a long time ago, like on the Sundance Channel or something. But I liked it a lot. Like it's visually amazing and very haunting soundtrack, and it seems related to Dawson, though I haven't seen that one. And the fact that you say he was paired with Guy Madden, I guess, makes all the sense in the world. But but Madden talks about making like docu-fantasia, I think is the word that he uses to describe at least my Winnipeg. So it makes me wonder that they paired them together. Is Dawson City a somewhat fictionalized kind of fantasy history of the discovery of these films, or
no,
is it?
No. No. So okay. Dawson City is also in Canada. It's used to be it before it was White Knight. What is it? White Horse or White Knight? I think it's White Horse. Before White Horse became the capital of the Yukon Territory, it was Dawson City. And what what Bill Morrison does is he uses the materials that are a part of the story. Specifically, it's these nitrate film reels and film snippets of silent films. Dawson City was the end of the line for route of silent films. So when silent films would leave L.A. or wherever they were produced, the last stop on as they went through Canada would be Dawson City. And then they would just destroy them. And so what ended up happening was because the nitrate film is so flammable, they just like buried it in the permafrost, and they discovered it 50 years later, and it was a really big find. But what Morrison does is he takes the physical reels, and so you see the decay, which is probably where Dickasia comes from. You see the decay on the reels, and then they tell the story of Dawson City and of the history of film in Dawson City through those reels. And the music is paired with is also very haunting. It's kind of a beautiful experience.
It's hard to think of any filmmaker that kind of can pair with Madden's aesthetic, but that from what you're telling me, it sounds in that direction, but probably not. Well, the next one was Richard Rush. So he has done The Stuntman, and I think if anything came to the collection, I think that's probably the one that people think about. He's done some bad films too. He did Air America. So he did, and then The Freebie and the Bean is a pretty bad 70s movie. When I say pretty bad, I haven't seen them. I have seen Air America. Don't ask me why I bothered. Color of Night, I think, was supposed to be okay. Psych Out, a few others. So I'm thinking this is probably a Filmstruck, but, or maybe physical release for The Stuntman. So any thoughts on Richard Rush?
I would say maybe Filmstruck, and it might be Psych Out, maybe some curation of films that are drugsploitation or midnight movies. And, you know, that film has sort of a storied history, and it's got Jack Nicholson in it and Bruce Dern and Dean Stockwell. So I'd be curious to see it.
That makes sense. And then the last one was Laura Poitras, who is a prolific documentary filmmaker, and she's done Citizen Four, The Oath.
Well, I wrote.
Sorry, Alexa's talking to me.
Oh. Sure.
All right, Alexa, I'm doing a podcast.
Is Alexa trying to get you to buy more Arrow Blu-rays?
Alexa apparently is a fan of Laura Poitras. So Citizen Four, The Oath, Flag Wars, and My Country, a few more. But they're generally, I don't know if I'd say advocacy documentaries, but more, a couple. My Country is certainly advocacy. Advocacy, I can't say it. Citizen Four was about the Snowden, wasn't it?
Yeah, about Edward Snowden. And I wrote and directed a film based on Edward Snowden. So I went and saw Citizen Four. Yeah. So that was really close to my heart at the time that film was being made. And I actually have a buddy who shot a lot of the exteriors for that film, because he specializes in like invisible geographies. And so he had access, or at least awareness, of some of the black sites that you see throughout the film. It's great. Like, it's really phenomenal documentary, but I don't know the rest of her work that well.
What's the name of the film you did about Snowden?
It's called Liberty Bait. And I also star in it, and it's kind of experimental. It's just been shown at festivals. Right now it's in competition for another one, cross your fingers. It's not Edward Snowden. It's just like deeply inspired by him. And kind of what I found exciting about him as a figure was not just like the moral stance that he took, but like that isolation, that like that life in exile, and what his emotional state must have been going through, you know, that process of leaving the country and leaving his girlfriend and ending up in probably the most ironic of all final destinations.
Yeah, especially today. So yeah, I figured this is probably Filmstruck. I can't see any of these being Criterion spine worthy. Nothing against Poitras, but it makes me think I would like to see more modern documentaries on Filmstruck. I think I wouldn't go so far to say that we're in a golden age, but I think the last 15 years of documentaries have just been stunning. I know we got Camera Person. There's probably some others I haven't thought of, but yeah, that's something I'd like them to shine more of a spotlight onto. All right, and another big piece of news, which we kind of know is coming, is Passion of Joan of Arc. There was a restoration trailer. And I watched it, and it looks about the same as the last one that I saw. But did you guys watch it, or do you have any opinions of Passion about Joan of Arc?
So I haven't seen... Passion of Joan of Arc was one of the first movies that I watched when I was getting into the BFI Sight and Sound Top 50. So it was a while ago that I saw it. I remember what's the actress's name? Falconetti?
Maria Falconetti, yes. She's amazing.
She's amazing. And then, but then hearing the story about her tree, how she felt about her experience as an actress in that movie, and it was very negative. But the movie's haunting. She's haunting in it. It's been a long time since I've seen it. I'd like to see it again. But I did not watch anything about the restoration trailer. I think I had heard you speak about it before on this podcast, so it sounds like this is something probably we've been expecting for a while.
Yeah, speaking of actresses going through a difficult role, hold that thought.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing... Were you going to say Belle du Jour?
No, I was going to say Hooper. But
oh,
anyway,
yeah, we know we have a lot of those on this list today. Yeah. Man, I'll tell you, I feel like I need to watch an Adam Sandler movie or something to cut all of the heaviness in some of the movies I've been watching recently. I need more of The Cobbler.
Nobody needs more of The Cobbler, but I get the sentiment. So, Jordan, are you a Joan of Arc fan?
Yeah, like John, I haven't seen it in a while, but I mean, what an incredible film, and I think it's so overdue. It felt like at a certain point this was one of their flagship films, and then it just sort of lingered on DVD, and you can watch just like a couple frames of it in vis-a-vis, but yeah, I can't wait till they get a new edition of this out.
Yeah, I think it went out of print, but really for no reason. I think they're just waiting for the materials. So, yeah, hopefully this means it's coming out in February. That'd be fine with me. And then the last thing is not a big deal. I added it just because I thought people might not know, but Netflix disc, you know, Netflix DVD is still kicking. I don't know if you guys subscribe. I actually had a little 2-month flirtation with it for a little while just to see if it was still good, and it was fine. But they Netflix is promoting that they have the Criterion Collection on Netflix, and so they have a page, I'll put it in the show notes, with a listing of all the films, and they're getting a lot of the new films. So for those, you know, anti-completionists that want to watch anyway, this might be a good option. I think they had a lot of the November releases. So are you guys still doing Netflix, or are you done? Jordan?
No, I mean, I obviously have the streaming service, but I haven't had discs for a while.
And it's The Lure, Personal Shopper, David Lynch, The Art Life, a whole bunch of others. So what about you, Jonathan.
So I used to have so I think this is just Netflix, the actual where they actually physically send you the discs, right?
It is.
Yeah,
yes.
And so I had this service a while ago, but then I started doing this thing called buying all my Blu-rays.
Yeah.
And I, you know, to this day I can't. I mean, I know why I do it. It's because every single time I get one of these things, I feel like I'm a part of the magic. Like, it's like I own a little piece of these films, many of which I love, many of which I've never seen before, and you get to experience them. But when I started doing that, I stopped subscribing to the Netflix delivery. But I actually had it not too long ago. It was how I started the Sight and Sound. But between mm-hmm. the Boston Public Library and the number of Blu-rays that I own and buy, it's not really necessary for me.
Yeah, me too. And I tried it just for new releases, but it's just so much easier to stream those. And a lot of them show up on Prime or Netflix pretty quickly streaming. So yeah. But if you don't like us like to buy everything, or if you want to just get the actual discs, which I would recommend over the streaming services, watching on disc and getting all the supplements, then there's that for you. And by the way, speaking of buying things, we didn't have the chance to mention, but Jonathan has been on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire since the last time we talked, and so I know you can't talk about it, and I don't even think you know when it airs. It's got to be soon, right?
I really don't know, because so with Jeopardy, what they do is I'm pretty sure that all of those episodes are in the same order that they've recorded them in. It's not. Right, it's obviously not live or anything like that.
I know this from my own experience.
Wait a second.
It's about a 3-month lag between the recording and air date, I believe. We recorded in January. Longer. We recorded in January and it came out in June. So when did you record?
Oh, damn it.
Are you allowed to say? Uh-oh. I guess he's not allowed to say.
Oh, my gosh. Guys, my thing dropped out.
Oh, we just thought you were being cool.
It literally, my Skype just came up with the message that was like, "Oh yeah, this is canceled." Sorry.
That's okay. Well, we were just asking when you recorded Millionaire.
And so
if you can say
that. Yeah, I can say that I recorded at the end of August.
Okay, so maybe a little bit of time.
Yeah.
And you'll get some notice when it's the air date, right?
I get a notice a week ahead of time so that I can do press.
Wow. Okay.
I just like saying so I can do press.
Yeah, no, I we've been there. We knew for Jeopardy, we knew about actually I think we knew the air date after we recorded. But I think Jeopardy, like you said, they're in sequence. So, well, I wish you luck for whatever I guess you came away with something. You can't answer, but the thing about Millionaire is you're there, so it's just how much, so right?
Yeah, everybody comes away with something, so everybody comes away with something. That's all I'm legally allowed to say.
Was it fun?
That's fair.
Did you have a good time?
Oh, it's the best. It's really overwhelming though, because Jordan, it's you're in. So with Jeopardy, there's three other people on stage with you. With Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, it's just you and the host, and like all the lights are on, everything's on you. It's a really overwhelming experience at first, but you know, after you answer the first question, you sort of settle in, and it can be really fun. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
I can't wait to see it. I to be honest with you, I haven't watched an episode in about 10 years. I think a lot of people might say that, but no, yeah, I'll definitely be looking for it.
I don't think I've ever watched an episode, so it'd be a brand new world for me.
Cool. Well, and you'll have a familiar face. So going from fun on TV, I think that's a good transition to the piano teacher.
It's the smoothest transition ever.
Can I jump on the Netflix train before we leave it?
Please, yes.
I got notified today that the horror film that I was starring in that was in theaters over the summer just hit Netflix today. So that was kind of an exciting notification. It's called Bedeviled.
Bedeviled. Streaming or disc?
Streaming.
Awesome.
Maybe on disc too. Not sure. Yeah.
I'm going to add it. It's good, right?
It is a... it's a teen horror movie, so it may not be heading to Criterion Collection immediately, but it's a gorgeous film. Like, it's great. The two guys behind it, Abel and Burley Vang, like are real visionaries, and they're already working on their next feature. So, yeah, it was a kick.
Cool. I'll check it out. Those I like those too. So how about, do you guys want to talk about, I don't know, genital mutilation?
Always.
Napkin sniffing. hockey.
Just say what we're talking about so that people don't get too freaked out?
Right. This is not bedeviled.
This is not. This is Michael Haneke's The Piano Teacher. So that was, this was 2001, I believe. It's really his breakthrough film. I know he had done Funny Games, which was which gained him some notoriety, but I think at least critically and on the award circuit, this is the one that really broke through for him. And of course, it's a Isabelle Huppert vehicle, and she is just amazing. I would say this before her work. I liked her in The Story of Women and La Ceremony, but here she just takes it to a whole different level on a lot of ways. But I had seen it twice before, but it had been this is not one you can watch every year. This is not a Thanksgiving movie, as you can imagine. But so it had been a good 10 years since I saw it. So was this your first time, guys?
No. This is actually my first Haneke film. I mean, when I saw it the first time, it was my introduction to him, but that was back when it came out.
And you haven't seen it since?
No, not till this week. I rewatched it.
So, and Jonathan?
Yeah.
First time?
It was my first time. Yeah, it
all
was.
Right, so I'm going to start with you, Jonathan. How'd you react?
So I think we'll talk about a few of the different aspects of the film. Huppert is amazing. In fact, that word is inadequate for
exactly
who she is and her performance of this. The movie is extremely beautifully shot, and the role that music plays in the movie, and there's lots of elements. The acting is phenomenal, not just her, but the mother and Walter Kremers, mm-hmm. I think. Just, you know, this is a really amazing film. With that being said, this is the first film where watching it in my house alone, I didn't just hide my eyes. I also turned my head, screamed into my couch over and over again, like a madman.
Was that the bathtub scene?
It was the bathroom scene. But what's most impressive about that is that I then watched the extras where Isabelle Huppert talks about some of the scenes. I watched the extras, and that scene came up again, and I did exactly the same thing all over again. So it wasn't just the shock and the surprise, which is what I thought it was. Haneke does not let the viewer off in any way, shape, or form with this movie. He attacks the viewer, and it's intentional, and it's provocative.
Yeah, I'd say that Haneke is provocative just in general, and I think in general he doesn't let you off. He's very challenging to the viewer. Actually, I don't think a lot of people could make a film like this. It's actually kind of amazing at that stage of his career that he got this film made. But Jordan, so you saw it for the first time a long time ago, and I did you like it the first time?
Yeah, I was startled by it. I mean, I think I went into it expecting something along the lines of one of those May-December movies that, like, Jake Gyllenhaal was making at the time, where like, him and Catherine Keener or him and Jennifer Aniston would get it on. So I was kind of hoping for something like that. And then I don't think I screamed into the couch, but I think my mouth was agape at the bravery of the way this story was told, and like the complete lack of titillation. I mean, this was not that kind of a story at all.
Not at all.
But I do think there are some tender moments in the film that are powerful because of their tenderness. I mean, it's really obviously very abrasive on the surface, and there's a lot of self-hate in this film that's explored. But I think it's a pretty complete portrait of this woman. I don't think it's one-dimensional at all.
No, it's extreme. It's a terrific portrait. I know it's easy to laugh about the shock value, but it is a character story, and people do have sexual hangups. That this is something that happens. Hopefully, not with a lot of people, but I think it does make the statement about repression, obsession. So you're not indulging yourself. So if you spend 30, 40, 50 years, I don't know how old Huppert was then, probably in the 40s, in her 40s, you know, focusing on one thing and depriving yourself of something else, you know, the mind is capable of a lot of terrible things. And again, I don't want to address the scandals this week, but we're learning about some of the real world stories here. I mean, nothing like the bathtub scene, but yeah, it's a tremendous movie. It's a difficult movie, a challenging movie, but I was floored by it 15 years ago. And then when I rewatched it, even though it is shocking, and I was floored by it again this week, just a masterpiece in my opinion, however challenging, and Huppert, I'd say performance of the ages. It's not just that she gets just every aspect of the character. She's tough. She, and you get as the piano teacher, how she can be, exacting, a taskmaster. But then you see that vulnerability, you see the hurt, you see that, the longing. It's just quite a character. And I don't want to spoil it, but even that final scene, I mean, God, it's riveting. Yeah.
And the tissue scene, I mean, as much as we can sort of point and laugh at the absurdity of that, I don't think it's absurd. It's just we're not used to seeing that. We're not used to seeing those kind of moments that people have with themselves, and that she has to lock herself in this little room that's not even a part of the space that she lives in to experience mm-hmm. that part of herself. I think it's very moving. And her lack of knowledge about herself, like how impenetrable she is to herself, is such a great dichotomy with how revealing she is to us. Like, I mean, Huppert's eyes communicate, you know, eternities. She is mm-hmm. so revealing in such a quiet performance, that.
Yeah, she emotes, better than, I really think she's a legend. I think she's one of the greatest actors that ever lived. So I know that sounds
agreed.
Like hyperbole.
No.
But yeah, her body of work stands for itself, even L. So, Jonathan, do you want to get on the Huppert train here?
Yeah, going back to what you were saying about the movie, it's like all of these things happen, and these people do things that are, whether it's self-harm or harm to others, sadism. There's one scene where somebody that actually really cares about another person, like, really harms them. And mm-hmm. Actually, there's multiple scenes of that. But there's one in particular where somebody who is like a surrogate mother to another character does like real harm to the character. But at the same time, the harm that she's doing is like almost like a gift, because it's going to save this person from the pent up and disappointing lifestyle that I mean, the movie. I care.
Oh, you're talking about the glass thing.
The glass scene. So, but I care so much about these people. That are many of them are mm-hmm. doing, whether it's weird or whether it's like cruel things to each other or cruel things to themselves, and but I just care about them so much. Isabelle Huppert, this is actually and this is embarrassing to admit it, but this is the first time I've seen her in a movie. The character she plays in this, it's interesting. I saw this right after I saw Dawson City, and so immediately my mind went to. This woman is like a reel of nitrate film, flammable and really tightly wound. Mm-hmm. But I'm sitting there watching this person, and I'm kind of falling in love with her. Like, I have real feelings for this character that, I wouldn't, like, it's a dangerous person, and yet I'm a fan of this film. It's a hard watch, but there are other hard watches where I think, Every single reel of film of that movie should have just been burnt as soon as it was made. And yes, I'm talking about Straw Dogs, but this is not that movie. This is both the challenge, but also like it delivers the goods.
Yeah, I think it's such a strong character portrait that even though she does some terrible things, some malicious things, and she's not a good person. I think we can agree. I'm sure what she does behind closed doors is probably okay as long as she doesn't do it to somebody else. Although, you could argue about that, but the character is drawn so richly and we see where she comes from. And actually the scene in question, I think you're right on. I think she's actually just trying to intervene and, she's doing it. It is self-serving, but she's also trying to prevent somebody from becoming herself. And I think she sees herself in that other character. So, and there's a lot of parallels, and also a love story. She's there's a little bit of a longing there. So
I'm not sure she's a bad person, though. I mean, would you really? I mean, I get that her acts do not describe a honorable or generous person or anyone who kind of has a world outside of like their own navel gazing. But that's part of what when she tries to sell herself in the one scene, I won't give anything away, but she does say this one thing that she's going to be like a baby, or they'll both be like babies inside and out.
Right.
And
right.
like that is a moment of self-awareness. I think that actually you can use to describe that entire character. Like when she puts the incident with the glass, like this is like what a tantrum that a child would have. I don't think she is even really that conscious of the repercussions. That doesn't mean she can't be held responsible, but I almost feel like the ways in which she's so tremendously emotionally stunted and still living with her mother and she thinks she's sexually adventurous because she has this imagination, but she's completely inexperienced at any of the ways that any of these things, love or sex or otherwise, actually mechanically work. And so it's that sort of like limbo state that she exists in that I think holds me away from judging her.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I think maybe you could say deeply flawed misguided, but I think the glass scene is really the smoking gun, and a little bit with the I don't want to get too much into plot, but a little some of her actions with the with her what's the name of the pianist,
Walter.
The other Walter, thank you. So anyway, well, this is a show that we don't do a too deep of a dive. It'd be easy to do an hour and a half show on this, and actually I think I want to. This is one I'd love to deconstruct, although I don't really want to watch it again anytime soon. So I'm glad you guys liked it. Would you say you just, Jonathan, like 10 out of 10, 9 out of 10? What do you think?
I need some separation before I make any aesthetic judgment on it. I know that it's absolutely beautiful. I know it's one of the best film performance. I mean, this is like you can draw the connection between this and Falconetti and Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's of that level of performance. And so there are many really great things about it, but I don't know exactly where I put it yet. I do know that this is something we could talk about for a while. I have a good friend who, she said, one of her favorite things to do is to take a challenging movie, particularly about women and violence, and decipher whether or not she believes it's like a positive feminist point of view. And this is a movie that is absolutely ripe for that sort of thing, and I'm woefully unequipped to be able to do it. So
I would love please have her on your podcast. I would love to hear that.
Yeah, she's perhaps the only person in the world where I called her up and I said, I have the perfect movie for you. It's called The Piano Teacher. So we'll see. I
would love to hear her take. Yeah, because this is from a male perspective. However, Huppert, and I think, you know, we talk about male, female filmmakers, but there are some actors, especially Bergman, for example. We've talked about that before. His actors, actresses were so prominent and had such a voice, Liv Ullmann, of course. So I think they can shape that to be, even though it's a male director, it's really, it does represent femininity.
That was my first response, was after reading about Huppert and hearing her talk in the extras and seeing her performance, I'm leaning towards that, because I don't believe that woman would have done it unless she felt that this was, you know, this was a positive piece of art in that sense. So, yeah, I feel the same.
I think you need to see more Huppert, my friend. So
oh, absolutely.
I'll give you some recommendations. So, Jordan, do you want to give a ranking or thoughts on how good, or do you need
rankings
to?
Are tough. Like, you know, it seems so random. But, I mean, yeah, it's with Huppert's performance, like, there are probably a couple of script things I would nitpick. But with Huppert, I mean, it's 9 out of 10. It's amazing.
Yeah. The letter, I might think that was a little much. Yeah, it fits with the character, but I guess, and also the misreading of social situations or the relationship. But
I would say that transitional sequence where the letter happens and then she does a pretty dramatic transformation of temperament there. And
yeah,
I think she sells it enough, but I would say at a script level, that's a little problematic. But, you know, nitpicks, it's a pretty tremendous film.
Any other actress, I think, and by any other, I mean really any other on the planet would have shown through more. And I think, again, that's a credit to Huppert. So, all right, Piano Teacher, fun. Who picked this one?
Yeah, Aaron, what are you doing to me? Last time it was Straw Dogs, now this. I mean, am I going to be on for the Sallow episode?
I think We're not going to have a silo episode, so that ship has already sailed. But anyway, it is a fun movie to flesh out. It's a deep movie. All right, so let's do some short takes. As people know, this is just a criterion we've seen recently, so it makes me watch a lot of movies, but I do that anyway. So I'll start with Jordan this time, since you're so close alphabetically. It's really too tough to distinguish. So, Jordan, do you have a short take for us?
I do. It's sort of like on the margin of, is this a qualifying short take or not? But this is going to be in the new Olympics box set, so I figured it counts.
It counts.
So I just covered the 1968 official Olympics film with David on the last episode of Reflections. And I wasn't going to do that segment with him, but there wasn't anybody else that was going to collaborate on that. So I just jumped in and thought, well, how bad could it be? And then it was an amazing film. Like, it was really visually stunning and just like everything I didn't know I wanted out of an Olympic experience. So then I started.
Which one is this?
It's called the Mexico Olympics, Mexico City Olympics, depending on where you're looking for it. I'm not sure what exact title criterion goes by, but it's the 68 Summer Games in Mexico City.
I guess we'll find out.
But to provide a little more context, because I'm not really a sports person, I previewed some of the other Olympics films to just get a sense of like, well, if this one is amazing, are they all like this? You know, is this just a lucky get? It was kind of a lucky get, but there were other things that I, you know, discovered. And so I want to talk about Visions of Eight, which is actually one of the ones that Criterion lists as one of the new restorations. I think they only say Olympia, Visions of Eight, and I think Tokyo Olympiad. And this is the film made for the 1972 Munich Games, which, of course, were and still are, like, mostly, you know, live in the context of that terrible Black September group,
right.
You know, violence against the Israeli athletes, and then the, you know, the terrible way in which the local police handled it that resulted in all of them dying at the airport. Mm-hmm. I guess two died in the initial violence, but. So this film was, of course, already, you know, in the works and in production, and so it was released. It vaguely makes reference to it in the John Schlesinger segment, but to give just like a brief, like, overview, it is a concept film. So David Wolper, this producer who did Roots and L.A. Confidential and Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, he commissioned 8 different filmmakers to do short segments that would then be compiled into one big anthology film about the Olympics that year. And he got like big names, Milos Forman, Arthur Penn, John Schlesinger, as I mentioned, Kan Ichikawa, and as I was previewing, right, just had to get some, I came across this like blue tinted, blurry, slow motion, silent sequence. And I thought, what is going on? So I rewound to the very beginning of it, and it is the Arthur Penn segment about pole vaulting. And it is like, it melted my brain how much I loved it. It was so avant-garde and so felt. And it's like these beautiful shots where eventually the athlete comes into focus and it's dramatic slow focus. And then you see the pole bend improbably, and then the body stiffens and thrusts into the air. And then, you know, there's such elation if the athlete, like, you know, makes it over the bar. And then there's the figure, like, almost frozen but already falling, like the moment of victory, the height of victory, and they're already on the descent like Icarus, you know. And it was so incredible that, like, seek this film out. I watched it not translated, but, you know, mostly it's a visual experience. Most of the commentary is, you know, sports casting anyway, so you can find it on YouTube. It's not the greatest resolution, but I think this is going to be, you know, a huge, you know, highlight of this new set. And the other segments are great too, like the Milos Forman set. You feel like you're with the Milos Forman of Fireman's Ball, where he's ridiculing bureaucracy and exhaustion. And then there's another segment about the people that lost their events. That's also very moving. It's a cool film.
It's possibly on, the IOC has some films, and we've talked about it on other episodes.
It's so not there.
It's not there.
Okay. For some reason, they don't have all of them. Like, they don't have Olympia. They don't have this. Mm-hmm. I think they don't have any films that don't play, like, to a mainstream audience. This is probably just too experimental. It doesn't feel like a document of the games. It feels more like, you know, just following the inspiration of these filmmakers.
Well, December 5th, we'll be able to watch it. Well, although you might have to, I don't know if people are going to go in order, but I still haven't decided myself. But anyway, Jonathan, do you have a short take for us?
I do. Jordan, that was awesome. I can't wait to see Visions of Eight now.
I know. Yeah. Thank you, Jordan. That was a great description.
I'm excited for the Olympic box set to watch a bunch of these, but that sounds pretty great.
And it's great hearing that from Jordan. You're admitted not a sports fan, so I think that makes a big deal. So I think pretty much everybody might be able to find something for them. So anyway, Jonathan, what you got?
So I have The Innocents. This is I've heard. I don't know, Aaron, if you had, because during October you had tweeted out a bunch of different horror movies that you really liked, and I saw Pulse based on your recommendation. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember if you put The Innocents on your list or if that's just something you had talked about at another time.
I probably did, but this, if not, I should have.
This was the second movie that I watched on my new Oppo, and it's absolutely gorgeous. And I didn't realize it was Deborah Kerr until I popped it in.
Yeah.
And I am a big Powell and Pressburger fan, so that was a really pleasant surprise. Beautiful movie. You and I also tweeted about it, and I think one of your friends is a big fan of this film, and he used a phrase that I loved. I think he called it the inky black and whites. Was it you that said that, or was it? Mm-hmm.
That's come up a lot, but it does have the inky blacks. That might have been me.
Inky black and white. It's just this is like black and white for people who are not fans of black and white film, which I know is not most of the people who listen to this podcast. But it's absolutely gorgeous. The castle or the mansion that it's shot in is also beautiful and haunting. The children are, again, beautiful and haunting, and Deborah Kerr's in it, so that should just suggest it all in and of itself. For people who don't know the Turn of the Screw, the Henry James mm-hmm. novella, short story, whatever it is, the thing about that movie is it's ambiguous whether or not there's a supernatural element or whether or not it's just in somebody's head. And I have a very definite take. The movie was intended to be ambiguous. I do not believe it is ambiguous. But, you know, that's my personal approach.
We might need to hear that offline.
Yeah, absolutely. But I totally think seek this movie out. It's gorgeously made. Truman Capote contributed heavily to the script, and lots of mm-hmm. gothic elements and some of Capote's humor. You know, this also is connected a little bit with The Piano Teacher, because a lot of people believe that part of what's going on in this film is a lot of repressed sexuality and the mental illness that can be related to that. So I'm a fan. Yeah. I think that this is one of the very solid entries into the Criterion Collection.
And I would say that Deborah Kerr is also a world-class actor who can emote better than most anyone, and she's terrific in this role. And I love that it captures the sense of dread that I think films, a week or two ago, we talked about post-horror and this new nouveau horror that's going on right now, but nothing comes out like The Innocents. I don't think they're filmmakers today can really tap into that, but it's my favorite gothic horror, not that there's a whole lot of those.
Because it's got magic, too. It's not just scary. It's not just, like, this tempting, dark environment. There's something kind of enticing about how magical it feels, and I love that ending.
Mm-hmm. And there is that one scene in the field. Whether it happens or not, it's creepy as all get out. Love that movie.
Yeah, and just one last thing. I actually got mm-hmm. scared a couple of times, and I don't typically get scared watching black and white horror films, and there was one of those scares where it's something from the distance coming at you really quickly, mm-hmm. and it's somebody's face, and it just made me jump. It's a pretty special film.
Did you put your head in the pillow?
No, that's like I said, that's a new experience for me.
That's just genital mutilation is what
that's just
brings
that's
that
just
out.
Hanukkah.
Yeah, well, keep watching Hanukkah. There'll be more of that. All right, well, mine is Sunday Bloody Sunday. Speaking of John Schlesinger, So yeah, in fact, I just watched it earlier today, just because I was running close to out of time. So my take is more of a hot take than a short take. I am a Schlesinger fan of, well, a lot of his work. I think his early work is pretty good. He's been in the kitchen sink movement. I really like Billy Liar and I'm forgetting one. Of course, he did Marathon Man and Far From the Madding Crowd. This is actually kind of a little of a both, but it's most notable for LGBTQ themes. And for 1971, this is something that you know, I think had been hinted at in film, but not as overtly as it is here. There's an iconic scene where the two lead characters, Murray Head and Peter Finch, embrace in a kiss. And this isn't a spoiler. It happens very early on. I think it was on the poster, actually. And what it does is it normalizes this behavior. And it's sort of a love triangle. And so I guess for the LGBT, it's there's a little bit of B and G and Q in all the characters. No L or T. And I think it's pretty good, pretty effective. I think what makes it important is how it normalizes that sort of the sexual relations and sexual politics. And I think it is a little bit on the melodramatic side. I do think a lot of Glenda Jackson and Peter Finch, I think they do a good job. Murray Head, I think he was probably better off doing that Bangkok song. But it worked. So anyway, I would sort of recommend it. I think it's important for, again, LGBTQ films. Pretty good as a post-Kitchen Sink and then pre-Hollywood Schlesinger film. So have you guys seen it?
I haven't.
I have not.
All right. Well, then there's that. So I guess let's get into Filmstruck. Are you guys ready?
Always.
Yeah.
Always. Well, we had the main channel, and the director of the week this week is Phil Carlson. And I am sorry, I did look at the list, and a couple of the names were familiar, but he is not somebody on my horizon. I've seen thousands and thousands of films, but every now and then. So Phil Carlson, just jump if you know anything by him.
Kansas City Confidential is supposed to be a pretty good noir.
That's right. I have heard of that one.
I'm in the same boat as you. I haven't seen any of these.
So yeah, I don't know which ones I should see or which ones are worth seeing. My wife is Iroquois, so the Iroquois Trail is interesting. I might check that out. Although, you know, a lot of those old Indian films aren't exactly going to make you feel good about Indian heritage. So, all right, well, we'll move on to somebody, I think, a pairing that we're more familiar with. We have Herzog and Kinski. So there were a handful of films about those two crazy lunatics. And I know that everybody says that Kinski is the lunatic, but Herzog was not exactly of sound mind either. So anyway, I'll start with you, Jonathan. Any thoughts on Herzog and Kinski?
So before I started watching film seriously, or before I knew what I was watching, I did see what's that documentary at the end? My best fiend.
Yeah. Oh,
so I watched My Best Fiend, and I sort of got the sense that both of them were complete madmen. But I saw Fitzcarraldo in the theater. In fact, at the Coolidge Corner Theater here in Brookline, Mass. And I think the guy who showed it said that it's actually it's Herzog's personal copy. I don't know if that's true, but it was amazing. Huh. And so I have never seen a Geary. And in fact, I didn't know that Nosferatu, I didn't know that was Kinski. So I'm really looking forward to seeing these. One of the things I got after the Arrow episode when I went region free, Blame Aaron, #BlameAaron, was I picked up the Herzog box set, so I'll be watching some of these very soon. Not sure if I'll be doing the Filmstruck or if I'll be watching the physical discs.
You will love Burden of Dreams. I'll just put – is that on the UK box? I can't remember which is – I have the Shout Factory box, which is amazing too. But Burden of Dreams is the documentary about Fitzcarraldo. And so there's a little bit of what's in My Best Fiend, but it's also – it's just – yeah, it's something. And also you get the Mick Jagger stuff too. Jordan, are you a fan of Herzog and Kinski?
Yeah, this is one of the most exciting, I think, little curated projects Filmstruck has put together for me, because I haven't seen a lot of Herzog in HD. I saw Fitzcarraldo a long time ago, and I put on today just for a couple minutes just to see that opening shot of Aguirre, where the hike down the mountain with the mist and space is like diabolically flattened out like a M.C. Escher. Like I cannot wait to watch some of these Amazonian river sequences. So I'm definitely going to be watching these. I haven't seen Cobra Verde, though. Have you guys seen that one?
I have. I've actually seen all of these, and that's thanks to the shout set. Cobra Verde is pretty good. It's a late film. I think that might be the last collaboration between him and Kinski, and it kind of has that Western vibe, very visceral. It's good. I would say it probably of this grouping, I'd say it's the least. I'm not a huge fan of Nosferatu.
Me neither.
I think it's okay. And I'm actually not, I like Aguirre, but I don't like it as much as, I don't put it on the pedestal that some other people put it on.
So you recommend Burden of Dreams is the big one I should see here?
For you, Burden of Dreams, because you love Fitzcarraldo.
I did.
And I love Fitzcarraldo too. But Wojciech is pretty good. I'd say. But really, I think even the weakest ones are still worth watching. Cobra Verde is absolutely worth watching too. Just don't expect Fitzcarraldo. And then we also had actually this might be a first, but we had the Marseille trilogy on the Filmstruck main the main channel, which I think is pretty cool. You don't get all the features that you did that you would for Digital Spine, but for those people that haven't seen Marseille yet and don't want to, how many people don't have the Criterion Channel that subscribe to Filmstruck? I don't think it's that many, but anyway, I love that. Well, I don't love, but I strongly like that trilogy. So, Jordan, have you seen it?
I haven't seen this yet. I want to, but it's just I haven't watched it yet.
It's a time commitment. Jonathan, have you seen it yet?
I had all three tickets when it. So I own the Blu-ray box set, but I also when it toured in Boston, I had three tickets, one for each, and I only saw the first one. So
bummer.
I liked it, but I wasn't totally blown away. But I am looking forward to revisiting it.
The middle one is not the best one, but the third one is pretty good. But they get longer as they go. So, all right, well, let's get to the Criterion Channel. So we had some Digital Spines. We had Still Walking by Kurita, and he has a big Arrow box that we talked about on the Arrow Now episode. So I this is not my favorite film of his, but again, that's not saying much because I pretty much love everything he does, but it's really good. Jordan, have you seen Still Walking?
Yeah, I have. I like it. It's a beautiful, quiet, melancholic film. I don't know too much about the rest of the films in his catalog, but I found this very striking. And the special features that they put up there are pretty good too. Really good interview with the director, Kurita, and another with his cinematographer where they talk about the mostly the things that they say overlap in this, like the importance of the world outside the frame of the camera, like the environment around the characters that I guess once Kurita made a documentary, he started really taking an interest in how do I activate the environment more once we're on the set and picking up small things. Like there's a boat at one point that's beached on the, at the waterline, and that wasn't part of the script. It was just there, but because he had learned how to be a little more spontaneous with his filmmaking, he incorporated it. And those are pretty cool supplements. There's also a making of.
Yeah, Kurita is so amazing. If you haven't seen his work, I would seek it out. So good. Jonathan, Still Walking?
Yeah, I really like it. I'm a fan of Ozu. And there have been a lot of discoveries I've had. I've gotten more into Criterion over the last year or two, but Ozu has certainly been a big one for me, particularly the color films towards the end of his career. Mm-hmm. And this film I saw After the Storm, and then an American film by a guy named Koganada, Columbus, early this year. I like the idea of anybody doing a contemporary take on an Ozu film, and I don't mean to be to just say that that's all that this movie is. The grandmother, mm-hmm. the mother in this movie, who also plays the grandmother in After the Storm, I like her so much as an actress. So it's always good to see her again.
Great performances all around. I really thought it's really good stuff with the actors, considering that they're often just sort of contained tightly together.
Yeah, and actually, I think that the Ozu comparison is fair. I'd say of his work, this is of what I've seen, this is the most Ozu-like or Ozu-ish. And I also saw Columbus, and that basically was an Ozu homage. But I still thought it was very good.
He resists that comparison in the interview. I don't know if you guys saw that. Yeah, he's like, I don't know why people say Ozu. And he says, I watch my films and I'm like, is this really like Ozu? Because I feel like people that, and I'm not, it's going to sound like I'm implicating you guys, but he says, I feel like people that say that, and this is Koreeda talking, have only really seen Tokyo Story. Because maybe Tokyo Story, there's some relationship, but he felt more like Naruse was not only where he found inspiration, but where he found kinship as a filmmaker.
I could see that too, but I think it's more the, at least with Still Walking, it's the quiet contemplativeness that I get the same, I guess, maybe not the technique. You know, he doesn't have that no moving camera and shooting from down low, at least not as much, but... but I guess just that tranquility while you watch it. So, but yeah, if he doesn't want to be compared to Ozu, that's fair. But we kind of can't help it. And I have watched a lot of Naruse's family dramas. So yeah, I see that too. I think it's probably some of the parts. All right. So then we have another digital spine, and I'm going to have to go a little quicker here. So we had Belle du Jour. So any thoughts on Belle du Jour? Is it terrible?
No. No, it's no. Boonwell blows me away every single time. He's somebody that I haven't seen enough of his films, so I still have a lot of movies I get to see for the first time of his. But each time I watch one of his movies for the first time, I'm pleasantly surprised.
Did you get the Region B box set?
Yes,
I knew it.
Yeah, and that was the first thing that I put in my Oppo. Like I said, the first thing I put in my Oppo was The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie.
Oh. From that set. Awesome.
Yeah. And so this is just more of the same. Belle du Jour, not more of the same. It's not like that, but just another movie mm-hmm. that I absolutely loved. And at times I sit there and I wonder, like, why do I love this so much? There are aspects of this that, I don't know that if anybody else put them together, it would be as successful. But man, this is a pretty great film.
Yeah, Benoit's a badass. Kind of all over the place, too. Jordan, Belle du Jour?
I feel very lukewarm about this film. I'm not sure why it's celebrated in the way that it is, and I'm not sure if it has something to do with the fact that we're talking about Piano Teacher this week and that film addresses a female masochist in a much more dimensional, thorough, interesting way. That this, in comparison, it feels very hollow to me. There's something I know maybe deliberately vacant about what Catherine Deneuve is doing, but you know, if this is a woman that's like consumed with sexual fantasy, even if just conceptually, like I don't see it. Like I don't see her pleasure. I don't see amorous intentions coming from the corners of her eyes. I don't see very much at all. And so I'm left kind of wanting. I like thinking about this film more than I enjoy watching it.
It's been a little while for me, so I really can't argue, but I think that's fair. I think it's not my favorite Buñuel, although that's, again, very high bar. But yeah, I do remember in hindsight liking it a little more. It's definitely a think piece. So if we weren't running long, I'd make you two fight about it.
And what I would do is I would then take my knife out of my walking cane, and I don't think, Jordan, you want to see what happens then.
But see, when you reach for your walking cane, you're going to find that there's shattered glass all over it, and you're not going to be able to attack.
All right, we can't keep this going. So we had a short plus feature, Washingtonia, and boy, I got to get better at watching the shorts. I've been a little slack on them. And Dogtooth, which I have seen. And I don't know if Dogtooth, I think the rights issues might be trickier for coming to Criterion, but I'm glad they got it for the channel. Actually, I didn't see. Did you guys check if it started with the Criterion logo?
It did not.
Okay. Yeah, probably not.
I was super curious because I know Kino has it, and I love that film. So
I like it. So anyway, Jordan, I'm sorry. Yeah, Jordan, go ahead. What do you think of Dogtooth?
I'm amazed by by Lanthimos, and this film is probably still my favorite of his. And yeah, I mean, I can't really say enough great things about it. In my opinion, I feel like this might be the best film we're talking about this week. Like, just the way that it addresses that captivity and contamination and that claustrophobic environment of the paranoia of the parents and the insecurity and the hunger and the brokenness and the false signal systems. Like, it's just such a well-crafted, like, beautifully enigmatic effort. I can't say enough great things about it. I didn't make it to see the short, so I can't offer a comparison there. But, like, yeah, this is a masterpiece, guys. This is a real incredible, unique experience. I don't know. I had heard a little bit about how great it was, so I went in with those expectations, and it still exceeded them.
Yeah, it does pair well with a piano teacher, actually, if you really think about it. Although it's a lot more surreal, not as linear, not as much of. I mean, it is a character study, but not like who pairs. So, Jonathan, Dogtooth?
No, but again, Jordan just sells it so well. I've been watching. I watched Killing of a Sacred Deer today, and I've just been watching.
Oh.
I'm not going to try to talk about it before you do. But so I've been watching several movies in this same vein recently. So I didn't actually get to see Dogtooth, nor did I get to see the doubleheader also from the Greek Weird Wave. But yeah, no. So I'm looking forward to checking this out now.
Yeah, he's quite a filmmaker. I like The Lobster quite a bit, even though I think that's. Aside from the animal violence, I don't know if it pairs as well with Dogtooth. Not as harsh. Anyway, so yeah, speaking of, you called it the Greek weird wave. Is that a thing?
Yeah, I think to be distinguished from just the Greek new wave, which was also like in the 60s, okay. Like the other new waves.
So Chevalier and Attenberg, and you've already mentioned Attenberg, I saw Chevalier and I thought it was decent, you know, very much about masculinity and machismo. But I thought it was a good movie, but it didn't really make me hungry to see more of her work. But you do recommend Attenberg, Jordan, right?
Yes, and I don't know why they put Chevalier first. Like, watch Attenberg first, and if you adore Attenberg, then be curious about the rest of the films offered there. Chevalier, yeah, it feels like a kind of conventional movie, right? Like there's not too much that feels innovative about it. I found it deeply satisfying, but yeah, it doesn't make you think, oh my God, who is this filmmaker? It's a great movie. Attenberg's different. Attenberg feels like, you know, her putting every ounce of her artistic instincts together in a coherent way. Her first film, like if you're curious about this filmmaker and you want to see her film work starting from the very beginning, I would discourage that. The first film they have on there, which is not part of this doubleheader, is very, it's a 2-hour experience. You feel at times that it's taking advantage of your time because it was thought of as a series of shorts and then put together at a certain point of production into a feature length film. It really should be a series of shorts. She seems artistically really interested in those kind of those segmented moments, like those disembodied moments. And sometimes Miranda July will do the same thing. Well, she'll have just like a brief fanciful episode. Attenberg is Tangari utilizing that instinct in a brilliant, coherent, wonderful, fulfilling way where it doesn't distract you from the narrative. It actually helps fulfill your understanding of the characters. And it's devastatingly sad in the best way. Watch Attenberg. And if you like it,
maybe
watch some of the shorts. And Chevalier, if you just really love her, it's worth watching. It's just not going to tell you, I think, as much about who she is as a thinker and an artist.
Yeah, I agree. I think thematically it's very obvious, but that's fine. It's easy to watch. But yeah, you sold me. I think I might try to squeeze in Attenberg tomorrow. Jordan, I convince people to spend money on Aero Discs, but you're convincing people to watch a lot of films.
You should just have like a phone line or a podcast where you just tell people what to watch.
Well, I guess David's show, you can kind of do that. And this show, too. I'm definitely having you back. So any final thoughts on the Greek Weird Wave, Jonathan?
No, I'm a fan of Lanthimos. I can't wait to watch Dogtooth. And I had seen Chevalier around and had planned on watching that. But now I know I need to watch Attenberg first. So looking forward to it.
Your queue is growing. So, all right, well, let's get to the fun stuff. The fun stuff, like anything, any of the stuff we're talking about here is fun. Although I think yours looks fun, Jonathan. What's your piece of flair?
So my piece of flair is the 2017 Palme d'Or winner at the Cannes Film Festival, and that is The Square. And this is a movie that I love on several different levels. It would be appropriately paired, although I don't know why anybody would want to subject themselves to this much black comedy, but it would be appropriately paired with Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri. It's like really darkly comic, and it is very much of its time, whereas Three Billboards is focused on the American political situation. This is more, I mean, obviously the American political situation factors into what's going on in Sweden and in Stockholm and where the square is set. But they're also dealing specifically with how do rich, well-to-do, liberal countries like Sweden, how do they deal with immigration, poverty, all of these sorts of things. It's particularly interesting from the perspective of there's a takedown on privileged liberalism and sort of focusing efforts into the arts and into film and into social media rather than just looking at the person next to them who needs help and being helpful. And it's and it does all of these things, which sound very heavy-handed and like public service announcement-esque. It does all these things, and it's just so hilarious. It's long for people that like long movies and films that take its time, but this does so in a way that you understand why every single second of the film is in there. I think it's gorgeous. Definitely recommend it.
I can't wait. I think we might see it next week, so here's hoping. Jordan, what you got?
Well, I'm going to take us back to the Greek weird wave, because I also just saw The Killing of a Sacred Deer, which is the newest film by Lanthimos. And, you know, I guess it's a somewhat controversially received film. Some people call it a misstep. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. It is more of a genre effort. So I think if you're really a diehard art house person, that can feel like a compromise. But it is done with the same sort of succinct, intoxicating interest in these like claustrophobic worlds that fold in on themselves and exploring the inadequacy of people. And it's actually horrifying. It is a horror film. And there are times where it is like deeply horrifying. I won't go into any specifics, but yeah, if you've heard that maybe it's not kind of on par, it is not The Lobster. If that's your main touchstone for this creator, it does feel very different from that. It's not a comedy. But I found the film riveting and I kept like, it stuck with like, I know I just saw it yesterday, but I mean, it really glued itself to the front of my brain. Like there's a final scene. It's not the climax. There's a final scene that I couldn't quite piece it together. Like what, why is it bad? Is it great? What is it? And I finally reconciled, like, I want to love it. Right. So I found a way in which it helped complete and then totally changed the way I thought about the rest of the film, which I think is maybe what a great ending does. But I would love to have a long form conversation about this film. And the performances are amazing. I've never seen Nicole Kidman, so good, so subtle and believable. And that, that kid, Barry Keoghan, who's also in Dunkirk.
Yeah, I will say I've never seen Nicole Kidman as subtle or believable either.
There's some Eyes Wide Shut parallels to draw here, but yeah, I mean, I wish the Nicole Kidman of this film had been able to do Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah, no, I don't want to hate on Nicole Kidman. I just saw The Beguiled not long ago, and she's doing well. She's doing fine. I think especially as an aging actress working in Hollywood. Well, I'm going to light things up here with my piece of flair. I watched Long Strange Trip, and that's the six-piece documentary about the Grateful Dead on Amazon Prime. And what prompted this was just us talking about that that Grateful Dead clue, the Jerry Garcia, and I remembered that I wanted to watch this. I love music documentaries. I don't love the Grateful Dead, although I like some of their music. I like their songs. I think they're tremendous musicians. I think Jerry Garcia was basically a guitar god in his own way. So I wasn't sure if I would get into this documentary. It's very long, and they do have a big story to tell. but I was riveted by it. It was very, it doesn't just cover the dead and that whole culture that surrounds them with the dead heads. And, you know, I remember being a kid of the 80s, you know, anytime the dead came to town, it was basically a freak show. And it kind of, you know, it went beyond the arena. It was just a big deal. But it also captures just the freedom and the free spiritedness of the 70s and 60s, and actually it does get into the drug aspect, and you can kind of understand what, you know, when you kind of, obviously you're not going to take LSD to watch a Grateful Dead documentary, but you can kind of see through their eyes, see what they're thinking, and see the appeal of it. And then there's also the sadness too. Of course, it's not a spoiler that Jerry Garcia passed away about 20 years ago, and to kind of, you know, see the trajectory of him as this this icon, really just almost like a supernatural icon. I think people actually literally worshipped the guy, and to see how he dealt with that is a little sad too. So yeah, it's easy to watch. I know it's six episodes, but they're about 45-50 minutes each, and they flow pretty fast. So if you're done with Stranger Things, watch this if you like music documentaries. So that's my piece of flair. And thanks, guys. Good episode. Thanks for joining.
Thanks, Aaron. It's awesome.
Absolutely. Thank you. This is my favorite podcast. One of my favorite podcasts. I listen to it every week. And Jordan is one of the best people to listen to talk about movies. So,
hold on. You said your favorite podcast, and then you said one of your favorite podcasts. So
I love Criterion Reflections and Wrong Reel and all those great, the terrific podcasts in our circle. But Criterion Now, this is you're like the town crier in our circle. Like, you're where people go to get the news in our little circle. So it's always exciting to come on.
I'm just teasing you. Those are all tremendous shows, and there are plenty of other great movie podcasts out there. So, all right. Well, where can people find you guys? See, alphabetically, Jonathan.
Yes. So I am on Film Baby Film, as you mentioned earlier, Aaron, and we are coming out with two episodes. This is going to be a lot of me around. I don't know if that's a good thing or not, but with this episode, and then I have an episode where I discuss Thor Ragnarok with Nick Pizzolatto, not the guy who directed and wrote True Detective.
Good.
But so we discuss that. And then tomorrow, as I mentioned earlier, I have a criminal defense attorney who specializes in defending murder cases is going to be coming on to discuss M. and the ethics of criminal defense work. So I'm thrilled about that. So check out Film Baby Film on the filmbabyfilm.com, Film Baby Film, iTunes, the whole thing, Twitter, Instagram, all Film Baby Film. So
all Film Baby Film.
All the time.
Jordan, where can people find you?
Well, apparently you can watch Bedeviled now on Netflix, so find me there. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram. I post a lot of photos to Instagram. I'm probably more active there than on Twitter. But my name is spelled Jordan, like the country, and last name is Esso, spelled E-S-S-O-E, like the gas conglomerate, but with an extra E for extra.
Good. You've probably said that a lot. All right. Well, and I'll put links to all your social media in the show notes. So you can find the show at CriterionCast, Masterfeed. You can find us in the Facebook group. Come hang out. We have a lot of fun. I'm on Twitter, AWest505. And basically, lately I've been tweeting about sexual politics and politics and film a little bit. So, and Roy Moore. He's an asshole. All right. Thanks. Good show, guys. Thanks.
Thanks.
Any show that ends with the word asshole is a good episode.
Roy Moore is an asshole.
I was going to delete that, but I think I'm leaving it in. He is an asshole.